Welcome to David Maister's Business Masterclass, a series of advanced business seminars exploring principles and practices for success in professional businesses.
Hello, I'm David Maister. This is How's Your Asset, the fifth episode of my series on career development. We're going to explore how you can avoid milking your existing skills and work to build new ones. At the end of my first full year as a management consultant, at the age of 39, I decided to take stock. How healthy was my career? I quickly discovered a disturbing paradox. My income statement was fantastic, but my balance sheet was deteriorating so badly, I was in danger of ruining my career, i.e., going out of business. Just before starting my consulting career, I'd published a few articles which had caught the attention of my target clientele, and I also had the advantage of having been a faculty member at the Harvard Business School for the previous 6.5 years. The consequence was that I was incredibly busy. What's more, I had had to do no marketing and selling because the phone rang constantly with requests for me to do work in the area in which I had built my budding reputation. I was not only very busy, but because I was being hired to do things that I already had a reputation for, I had relatively few problems with fee levels. I made a lot of money then, more than I hoped for. All seemed to be going very well. But was my business or my career truly healthy? I remembered my business school training, which taught me that to judge the health of a business, you have to look at the balance sheet as well as the income statement. But what made up the balance sheet of my career? I could think of two groups of assets for a career. We'll ignore for a moment my liabilities, particularly the personal ones. The first group of assets on which my career was based was my inventory of knowledge and skills. People get paid for their time, but that's not what we sell. We sell knowledge and skill. The second potential asset was my client relationships. Much to my surprise, I discovered that both had deteriorated badly. The problem with my knowledge and skill was that I hadn't learned anything new. By definition, the unsolicited phone calls requesting my services had been for things that I was already known for. Even though each client project in those early days was customized to a degree, I found myself basically doing very similar work for a variety of clients. I had not added to my inventories. I had not added to my abilities. What was even more shocking and depressing was the realization that not only had I not grown my asset, but its value on the marketplace was going down rapidly. Left untended, a given amount of knowledge and skill, like all assets, depreciate in value surprisingly quickly. Other people learn how to do what you know how to do. When I first started out, the ideas contained in my articles on which I'd launched my business were relatively new to the market, and I could therefore command a premium fee to consult or speak about them. However, with each passing month, the price the market would pay for those ideas and the related skills and knowledge would decline. There were probably more potential clients out there to whom I could keep selling the same old stuff, but if I kept this up, my skills would eventually be out of date and worthless. Already the danger signs were there. Friends amongst my client base told me that people were saying, "Oh yeah, we've had Maister in and heard his stuff. What else has he got?" Even with ongoing clients, they clearly didn't value as highly what I was doing the second or third time I did it for them as they did the first time. The value of my asset was definitely going down. There was also a strange problem with the second group of my assets, my client relationships and reputation. If I had published a personal brochure about my consulting career to date, it would have looked very impressive. I had worked for a very large number of very prestigious clients. It felt like my client and contact list represented a real asset. But was there any real value there? It quickly became clear that my client relationships would have a high value if and only if the next time the client had a problem in my field of interest, I had a high probability of getting the job. Now that would have been worth something. But the truth was, that wasn't the case. I realized that having done one thing or a limited set of things for a wide variety of clients meant that I hadn't really developed relationships that promoted the chance of me getting their next interesting assignment. I realized that the value of my client relationships was not to be measured by the number of my clients, nor by their prestige, but by how deep the relationship was. I would have been better off, I realized, if I had worked for fewer clients but done a variety of things for them so that they would have had a chance to see the range of my skills and had had the chance to work with me enough to learn to know me and trust me when new things came up. As I worked to address these problems in subsequent years, more harsh realities about my work life became evident. Unfortunately, I discovered that it was harder to generate asset building work than to sell what I was already known for, already had methodologies for, already had written articles about, or already had references for. If I took the line of least resistance in my marketing and selling activities, in other words, sold what it was easiest to sell, chances were that I would milk my asset, not build it. Second, I learned that doing asset building work was often more stressful and sometimes less fun than doing what I was already good at. Doing the type of work that was easiest and most comfortable was not necessarily what was best for my career. In fact, it rarely was. I realized that in professional life, if you're comfortable, you're heading for trouble. In sum, I learned that unless I actively worked at it, my career prospects would inevitably decline, even when I was making lots of money. Maybe even especially when I was making lots of money. Having a good current year financially was clearly a necessary condition for my success, but it was far from being a sufficient condition. Keeping my career moving forward, even staying level, was going to take some conscious effort. There were two pieces of good news in all this. First, I discovered that if I was prepared to work at it, then there did not have to be a trade-off between my balance sheet and my income statement. If I could be diligent and clever enough in my marketing and selling, then I could be as busy on asset-building work as I had been on asset-milking activities. Furthermore, if I did it right, I could deserve and earn higher fees for learning, growing types of projects than I was able to earn for the stuff I knew how to do years before. My current busyness and prices did not have to suffer. I just had to learn how to manage my flow of work and be sure to build new skills, continually and forever. The second piece of good news was that it was possible to get hired for assignments for which I had no methodology, no references, and little, if any, experience. The secret turned out to be that while new clients were unlikely to hire me for such things, an existing client who had, during the current assignment, had the chance to see me in action and learn to trust me, might, if I played my cards right, give me a chance. I learned that investing my practice development time, i.e. marketing and selling, with existing clients rather than new clients was more likely by far to help me grow my asset. The second or third or fourth assignment from an existing client, assuming the projects were different, were definitely more likely to deepen my knowledge, broaden my skills, and make an asset out of my client relationship than another first assignment for one more new client. That's what I learned in my first year. Since then, I've learned that these experiences were not just the problems of the early stages of my career. In fact, the more successful I got in later years, the greater was the temptation to exploit existing skills and relationships, and the harder I had to work to make sure that I didn't just cruise, letting my balance sheet slip away unexamined. After having observed thousands of people in a wide variety of professions in numerous countries, I conclude that the lessons still apply, not only to me, but to everybody at any stage of his or her career. To grow your asset well requires a plan, one designed to make your asset increasingly more valuable on the marketplace. You have to find ways to continue to develop the knowledge and skills that your target clients value. In essence, we all need a personal strategic plan for our careers, inside an organization or outside. What can you do to promote your learning apart from being exposed to a variety of experiences? Traditionally, most people acquire their skills and knowledge by opportunistic insights, not structured learning. However, you can rely too much on random experience as a teacher. To learn well, you have to set out to learn specific something. This requires focus. Like most people, I enjoy variety in my work. I have wide interests and enjoy learning new things about lots of different things. Yet I've learned from my own career and from watching those thousands of other people that if you want to create a truly valuable asset in yourself, then you have to focus your attentions on building a highly specific set of knowledge and skills. you have to figure out what you want to be famous for. This is true not only because focus means that individual pieces of learning are more likely to be cumulative and hence speed up the value creation process, but also because with ever-increasing intensity in each business, customers and clients demonstrably value specialization. If we want our asset to be valuable in the marketplace, we have to consider what our customers and clients define as value. With every passing year, I've relearned the importance that clients give to specialization in their kind of business. In other words, specialization either by industry or by type of client, such as family-owned business, government agencies, Fortune 500, or international organizations. Meeting this client need does not mean working only in the one industry 100% of the time. It does mean being sufficiently well-informed and experienced to stay current on their industry developments, converse with them on industry-specific issues, and being able to offer your professional skills in a way that does not require the client to do any mental translation of generalities or terminology into his or her specific situation. For example, I've learned that the seemingly low level of diligently reading my clients' industry trade magazines, newsletters, trade association materials, every single month without fail, has made me a more valuable person in their eyes. Choosing an industry or type of client focus is a problem for many professionals who worry about over-specializing. When I began, I too wanted to work with more than one industry, or in my case, profession. And I faced what is a common problem. How did I get to the ultimate goal of both breadth, the variety of clients that I find fun and fulfilling, and depth, the detailed knowledge of industry specifics that clients value? I conclude that the correct approach is depth first and then breadth. By first focusing on clients in a specific single industry, you'll more quickly build knowledge and skills that they value and will be more quickly exposed to a variety of asset-building types of assignments, and you'll more quickly build client relationships. Only after having done this once is it wise to begin branching out. If you took the opposite route, breadth first, you'd be accumulating lots of little pieces of knowledge in a wide area and establishing numerous minor client relationships, which is not the best strategy for fast skill building. It's important, I've learned, to make a distinction between knowledge and skill. Knowledge is relatively easy to accumulate quickly, but it also depreciates quickly. Skills are hard to win, but keep their value a little longer. Further, I've learned that it's important to distinguish between technical skills and counseling skills. Growing one's professional technical skill is, of course, a minimum requirement for keeping one's career alive. However, it's been a fascinating lesson to observe that it's really only a special few that have been able to build their careers on technical skill alone. These few, the gurus, the rocket scientists, the brain surgeons of their specialty, somehow have persuaded the market that they are closer to the frontier of their discipline than the rest of the possible providers. For the vast bulk of the rest of us, technical skill alone is rarely enough. To be valuable in the eyes of clients, I've learned, sometimes through bitter experience, that it takes a variety of interpersonal skills that I lump together under the title of counseling skills. We can be more valuable to our customers, our clients, and our bosses if we not only solve problems and tell people what they should do, but help the client understand more. This includes helping the client look at issues in a fresh, more revealing way, helping the client see what the options are and what their relative advantages and disadvantages of the options are. This activity sounds simple, but I've truly learned that it's a skill, and like all skills, take practice. I, in fact, wrote a book about this called The Trusted Advisor. I can report that some people are terrific at it, and others, probably the majority, including myself, could do with some improvement. What cannot be in any doubt is that effectiveness in this area is something that clients value highly and hence builds one's asset and one's career prospects. Other skills fall into this category of counseling ability. Most professionals find themselves working with more than one executive as their client. Accordingly, the client will get greater value from any ability the professional has to deal with groups. Help the client organization arrive at consensus where none existed before. Reconcile and handle diplomatically conflicts of views amongst client personnel and so on. Again, what I've learned is that these schools are called upon not infrequently, but in the regular activities of most people's work. The question is not, what do you know? The question is, what can you do? With all these thoughts in mind, I've worked hard over the years to manage the mix of my business, and I think I've succeeded most of the time. I was lucky enough to be given the chance to work on a variety of interesting, challenging, new types of assignments. A while ago, I gave myself a test. "Okay, David," I said, looking at the face in the mirror, "what do you know now, or what can you do now that you didn't know or couldn't do a year ago? In what ways are you a better professional than you were 1 year ago?" I watched my face turn red. "I know I've learned something," I replied, "but I'm not sure I can tell you what it is." "Why not?" I quizzed the face in the mirror. "Well, the problem, you see, is this. I've had lots of interesting experiences, but I'm not sure I've figured out what they've taught me. I've had my share of successes, but I've never paused to reflect on why that particular assignment went well. I was all too busy to dash on to the next assignment. And unfortunately, I've also had my share of failures, client assignments that didn't work out as planned. And there I was even more eager to dash on to the next piece of work and not look back on what went wrong. And even if I did look back, I have to confess that it was more normal for me to think about what the client people did wrong, those darn clients, than about what I could have done better. Since I was talking to myself, I indulged myself in an old joke. The trouble is that some people have 5 years experience and other people have 1 year's experience five times. The difference, of course, is in the ability to learn. Experience is the best teacher, but you have to do the homework. I realized that if I was going to build my knowledge and skills, it was not enough to have a wide variety of experiences. I had to work at learning from them. There are four kinds of debriefing that I have found valuable in promoting learning. 1, all by yourself. 2, with your team, assuming that others worked on the assignment with you. 3, with the client. And 4, just with your peers generally. First, debriefing alone. I find that if I force myself to examine my work experiences, taking the time at the end of a project to ask myself what went well and why, what didn't go so well and why not, I almost always come up with something that will help me get better next time. I find that if I take notes, keep a written personal journal, I'm more likely to remember and apply the lessons next time. Debriefing with the team has the same goal and the same questions. However, debriefing with a client adds an entirely new perspective. By asking a client to review the assignment with me and tell me in retrospect what we, the client and I, could have done better, what we might do if there were a next time, I found that I get a great deal of assistance in growing my asset, particularly in those areas of working with client personnel that are so important to the clients, but so easy to neglect in the hurly-burly of getting the project done. I've learned that if you ask, clients will be honest with you about what you could improve. Often the things they say you were already aware of, but the act of asking forces you to confront and deal with your relatively weak areas. Many firms have organized efforts in this area, including mail questionnaire. Whether or not your firm adopts this approach, I suggest that it's in your interest to arrange your own client feedback just for yourself. By taking every opportunity to discuss your work with your peers, you can create the chance that you will derive value when they ask, "Why did you do it this way? What would happen if you did it a different way?" Other devices can help skill building. Many of the key interpersonal skills all professionals need fall into the category of what I call the cabin attendant test. The airlines teach their cabin attendants how to deal with a rowdy drunk at 35,000 feet. They even coach them in prepared scripts on precisely what to say to accomplish the desired soothing effect. However, knowing what to say is easy. Having the skill to pull it off in real time is an entirely different story. So it is with some counseling skills. How, for example, do you tell a client that he or she is wrong without being rude, confrontative, or challenging? Doing it well takes skill, not just knowledge, and a person without that skill will not have great career prospects. The answer, of course, comes from practice. But it must be practice in a situation where you can afford to fail, afford to watch yourself, try different approaches and learn. That means rehearsals and role plays. Some of us can develop those skills rapidly by repeated experience in front of real clients or real bosses. For most of us, a little offline practice would work wonders, particularly if there's a video around. It's also a good idea to get on as many joint projects with people from other disciplines as possible. We learn and develop from our work experiences, and if you get a chance to be on the same assignment as a top person from some other area in your firm, you're going to learn. And learn in a way that no amount of reading or offline conversations with that person will ever provide. Figure out who has something to teach you and find a way to work with that person. Whether you are 25 or 55, you'll always need to worry about where your career is going from today. As you think about your career, here are some questions for you to ponder. In what way are you personally more valuable on the marketplace than last year? What are your plans to make yourself more valuable on the marketplace than in the past? What specific new skills do you plan to acquire or enhance in the next year? What's your personal strategic plan for your career over the next 3 years? What could you do to make yourself even more special in the near future? What precisely is it that you want to be famous for? This concludes How's Your Asset, the fifth episode in my series on career development. It was based on a chapter of my book, Managing the Professional Service Firm. In future episodes, we'll look at developing the skills of friendship, client relationships, and the ability to manage others. As my first year of podcasting winds to a close, it's time to practice what I preach and ask you, my listeners, for your feedback. I hope you'll be willing to take just a few minutes to let me know what works for you with the various business masterclass series I have done, what doesn't work, and how I can make the podcasts more helpful and enjoyable for you. You can find the survey at davidmaester.com/survey, and I look forward to your ideas and suggestions.